nz/Green Auckland.
This is Bruce Lipton, and you're listening to Green Planet FM.
Kia ora, greetings, and welcome to Green Planet FM 104.6. I'm Tim Lynch, and I trust that you are doing well. I invite you to stay with me over the next hour as we discuss and find ways to take care of our unique and magnificent green planet Earth.
Welcome to Green Planet FM. I'm Dennis Frank, here today to bring you an interview with one of the pioneers of environmentalism in Aotearoa. Dr. Robert Mann has been a scientific advisor to cabinet ministers in our government. He was a founding committee member of the New Zealand Foundation for Peace Studies and co-author of the New Zealand government submission to the World Court for the lawsuit against French nuclear testing in the Pacific. Dr. Mann served for 8 years on the Environmental Council Working Party on Energy and 11 years on the Toxic Substances Board. As an active conservationist, he was branch chair for Forest and Bird and was for 12 years a director of the Environmental Defence Society. He's now retired from a distinguished career as a university lecturer in biochemistry and environmental studies. After graduating with an honours master's degree from Victoria University in the early 60s, he went off to do his doctorate at UCLA Berkeley. I began by asking him about that.
I arrived in the mid-60s and I was there in no hurry to depart. It was a very pleasant way of life in many ways. I was at Berkeley for the latter half of the 60s, doing a research doctorate and skiing and holidaying in Mexico and so on. I have, of course, not claimed any distinguished academic record, but yes, I was in the University of Auckland for a couple of decades. First of all, in biochemistry, I was hired to teach at first medical students and then later science students, some of whom have made distinguished academic careers. And then in 73, I took part in forming the environmental studies course, which no longer exists, but was an undergraduate applied ecology general paper for people taking almost any degree. So I was lucky enough to be very active in science-based conservation during its period of flowering, and compared with the last couple of decades, it was a period of considerable success and with relative ease. But I became interested first, before I left Berkeley, in the anti-war movement and got involved against various nuclear weapon capers, including the so-called anti-ballistic missile con. And then when I arrived back in New Zealand at the end of the 60s, I was soon approached by the then chairman of the New Zealand Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament, Richard Northey, who was at the time a junior lecturer in political studies, but later, of course, a member of parliament and now Auckland City Councillor. And I was asked onto the committee of the CND. And then in 72, we had this, looking back, remarkably rapid and successful caper, beginning with the Greenpeace 3, as it was named, but the name of the ship was originally the Vega, and the New Zealand CND prepared that ship in 10 days flat to go to Mururoa. And that was including a period when the skipper, the late David McTaggart, was convicted and written up, of course, gleefully by the Herald for smuggling watches. But we got that boat away in 10 days flat, got volunteers for crew, and then sent several other boats to the French illegal nuclear test zone and in the South Pacific. And all of that was done relatively easily and with very little internal strife. I then got involved, and from August 71, in campaigning against the herbicide 245T, especially aerial spraying of 245T, and drew attention to the very toxic impurity dioxin, in which the New Plymouth made 245T was particularly rich, relatively speaking. So I became an annoyance to the Dow company, and they complained, and the captain of industry, who was the vice chancellor, that is to say the head manager of the University of Auckland, tried repeatedly to sack me, and it gives me pleasure to say that the biggest staff meeting ever occurred in, to support me, declare esteem for my work, deplore the attempt to purge me, and Maiden wasn't able to purge me that time. That was the main attempt in 77, and then he made a couple of more minor ones later on. So I was a visible activist, scientist, explaining dangerous technologies to the general public. I should say I had some models in this. Linus Pauling, the chemist of the 20th century, and a model activist scientist explaining, he got the Nobel Peace Prize for explaining the significance of fallout from atmospheric nuclear explosions. And Pauling, to me, was one of the models. Another one was Henry Kendall, now also deceased, whom I brought to New Zealand for the first New Zealand Energy Conference in 1974. This was a very successful conference and led to a book called Energy in New Zealand, which I edited. And in those days, things were done much more rapidly. And the main reason why I'm prepared to be interviewed now is that no comparable efficiency or rationality is now in evidence in, well, any direction you look. Forest and Bird is still a relatively efficient bureaucracy, I'm happy to say, and produces a pretty good magazine, but not a lot else is going on, and the Green Party has become mainly the spearhead in our legislature for sexual deviations. That's its prime concern. So I'm wishing to set forth a sketch of how I see things having gone wrong. In New Zealand politics, the power of the public to be informed and to be politically active for conservation has been very seriously degraded, and I'd like to sketch the political ideologies which I think have acted as cross currents and are now dominating our country, and that happens to cripple the conservation movement. The awareness that there's too much industrial activity, there are too many chemicals, especially synthetic chemicals that never occurred in nature, being spread around still, in particular the most dangerous technology ever, gene tampering, called by its proponents genetic engineering, that is going on practically unchallenged because the movement against it, which I began in this country back in the mid-70s when first genetic engineering was invented, that movement has now been taken over by politicians, political activists who are not aware of the matter, cannot discuss the subject, and therefore are not of any use in supporting proper citizens-based activism against what I say again is the most dangerous technology ever, which our dear Tim Lynch has interviewed me about a couple of times on this station, so I won't be going into the matter of genetic engineering in any detail today, but I do complain that there's no practical opposition to it of any sensible science-based kind. So I say that what has happened is that over the last three decades, New Zealand politics has been taken over by what I call a PC axis. I'm against political correctness, which is an old term, actually began with Lenin. But in the modern era, political correctness means a set of attitudes which have been described. Robert Hughes, prominent Australian author, published an early book on it called Culture of Complaint. And what has happened is that a mode of political action was developed, first of all, by the movement that most people call feminism, a very misleading name for it, starting in the late 60s, surging up and through the 70s. It was found that wallowing in the victim role, acting victimized, and saying that you're a victimized minority can get you millions and millions of dollars of public funds, but also wrongful influence in the judicial system within science, wrongful promotion of people who are unfit for high office, and many of them are now doing considerable harm in Parliament and especially in public agencies. So the PC axis, which is of three parts, tripartite PC axis, ideology number one, the dominant ideology, the longest lived so far, women's lib. I honour my late friend Teddy Goldsmith, who has been a leader of the sort of philosophy that I advocate, science-based conservation. And Teddy always said it shouldn't be called feminism, it should be called women's liberation. That was its early name. And it's certainly not feminism, it's certainly not in favour of the feminine in the human being. Women's Lib is the number one political party. The second one, which is in the news just at the moment, is the new racism. People who say they're of Maori extraction wallow in the victim role and act hard done by, lie about the history of this country, and I resent that really strongly, and get hundreds of millions of dollars of public money thrown at them, and more importantly, very considerable public resources, public property that shouldn't be alienated to any particular party. The new racism, which has a lot of overlap in membership with Women's Lib, is the number two ideology in the PC axis, and bringing up the rear, the newest, who began wallowing in the victim role most recently, militant homosexualism. That is the political activism characterized by Tim Barnett, MP from Christchurch, it was, now a Labour Party official, turning the promotion of homosexuality into a political cause. Militant homosexualism is the youngest member of the PC axis. And this is a regrettably shambolic picture. Nazi Germany was simpler, it would appear. The current PC axis, which most people don't see, but which I've been writing about for a couple of decades, is, I think, really crippling all effective movements to limit industrialism, decrease pollution, and so on.
These social movements that you're talking about began as natural, healthy, back in the 70s, reactions to the patriarchy, the historical power structure, and the mind-numbing conformity that was imposed on those of us born after World War II.
Yes, exactly, and unfortunately, they've all, beginning with reactions against genuine injustice, they've all gathered far too much momentum and like a pendulum have swung clear through any region of reasonable balance, picked up maximum momentum and swung clear out the other side to become caricatures of themselves in a way. I supported Women's Lib in the early 70s. I remember when Germaine Greer came out here. Matter of fact, she looked at me in a rather dangerous way, which at the time I was flattered by. But it took me until the mid-80s to see how wrong Women's Lib had gone. But yes, it began with some legitimate complaints. Similarly, of course, what my dear old colleague Rangi Walker calls the Maori Renaissance began with some legitimate complaints, and people set about rectifying them, not as fast as should have been, but by and large, that's what's been going on. But a lot of illegitimate complaints have also now been generated, and it's getting crazier. Let me mention, please, where people can read about this sort of thing. My own writings from two decades ago, which I'm only too happy to refer people to because I see little reason to revise these assessments. I use an offshore website, of course, so that cyber attacks such as have crippled various good websites in New Zealand are much harder to do. People can read my writings in quite a range at www.kuratrading.com. That's Kura, K-U-R-A-T-R-A-D-I-N-G, kuratrading.com. manwritings.com. And on that site, search for Man Writings, and you should get my list of essays and articles. And in 1989 and then in 1991, I reviewed with my colleague Andrew McFarlane, now gone to the Gold Coast, the view of PC, which I've now simplified, really, as I just summarized a minute ago. And then regarding the new racism, there are some very good writers. One is John Robinson, who's a former applied mathematician in the old DSIR, and he's been putting out quasi-underground books. My favorite is The Corruption of New Zealand Democracy, A Treaty Overview, John Robinson. And that is a very good account of some specific corruptions in the claiming industry, which Winston Peters, to his credit, calls it. And the firm that puts out Robinson's books lately is Tross, T-R-O-S-S, Publishing, firm in Wellington. So one can read if one wants to, but I'm afraid not a lot of reading is going on, especially the New Zealand media generally, who are incomparably lazy, can't be bothered to read about things like genetic engineering, and they therefore just use an issue like that as a vehicle to publicise politically ambitious individuals that the media operatives favour. It's a pretty dickened state of affairs.
Well, the thing about the mass media is it's driven by the need to entertain rather than inform. So, you know, the owner-operators of the media are always trying to get an interesting angle on things. It doesn't have anything to do with pursuit of the truth or understanding what's really going on in the world.
Yes, that's dead right. Exemplified by Holmes, that's quite right. That infotainment is now their basis for selling advertising time, but it is worse than that because, as I'm suggesting, people, especially in Radio New Zealand, salaried people will select who gets in the media and who doesn't in a way which is PC-driven. That's the situation. So some very obscure and embarrassingly third-rate women get brought on and treated with great respect by especially Radio New Zealand's main hatchet harpy, Him Kill, real name Fiona Hill, and she always squawks at and downrarks male interviewees when they're on at all, but very obscure and dubious female interviewees get great respect. So the media functionaries are really using the media to promote PC, not just to sell advertising time on the basis of infotainment, but the infotainment itself is warped in exaggerating the advantages of various decadents and certainly not reporting the serious disadvantages in several major trends. As I say, genetic engineering is the worst, but the trend to appoint people because they're female, preferably lesbian, to heavily paid important public positions, that's got right out of control, I'm afraid. And then when the head of the Ministry of Education, who has benefited from that trend, quietly slips out, relinquishes her huge salary, the media scarcely mention it. How many of our listeners now noticed that a very PC lesbian activist who'd become the head of the Ministry of Education quietly slipped out, departed some months ago, and the media didn't make anything much of that because, of course, that might lead to examining her record. And what's been happening since in the school system is, if anything, even more shambolic. So we no longer have a good public school system. We don't have a good Ministry of Education. And one of the reasons is that people have been appointed to high rank on PC criteria rather than on their ability to do the job properly.
Yeah, I mean, certainly a big difference between when we grew up, when the idea of the meritocracy was taken for granted. People only got ahead in life according to ability in those days. To some extent, the old traditional wisdom applied, it's not what you know, who you know. That has always been part of the fabric of human society. But I remember back in the 60s, the ethic was excellence, and everybody was geared towards achieving that.
Oddly enough, they hardly ever said the word, whereas lately the word excellence is intoned embarrassingly often by people who wouldn't know what it means. But yes, New Zealand was the nearest thing to a meritocracy that has ever existed, in my opinion. And within that, of course, to an extent, it's who you know. That was bound to function, and so it must. And it's not entirely evil. If I'm considering a range of people for an appointment to a significant position, if they're all rather similarly qualified, but if I know one of them from years of collaboration and doing science together and so on, I will, of course, intend to appoint that person. And there's nothing wrong with that. We were the nearest thing to a meritocracy, and I've sung its praises in an article on the website stuff.co.nz. I have a little piece been on there for a decade, to my very pleasant surprise. Just search Stuff for my name, there's not much there.
I should point out, Bob, that your surname is spelt with a double N rather than a single N.
Oh yes, I have discovered one person with that other name that you mentioned. He was the first secretary of the RNZAF when it was formed. May have been from Burma, but of course otherwise the name has two N's.
Yeah, and that, of course, is crucial to working the internet.
Yes.
If you get one digit wrong, you don't get the destination.
Yes, it's a rather tiresomely precise thing. And the internet, of course, is the context within which PC ideologies have burgeoned, and a great deal of misinformation is promulgated over the internet. I agree with D.T. Suzuki, the famous Canadian geneticist and ecologist, who was to Australia for about a decade what Bellamy, that ill-spoken POM, was to New Zealand, the overseas expert on ecology. D.T. Suzuki, in my opinion, is a far better scientist and talks much more sense. And he says, don't give children computers, give them magnifying glasses. And I modify that and try to get it printed in a local newspaper. Fresnel screens, those thin, flexible plastic sheets, usually with a cardboard frame and numerous concentric circles, a thing called a Fresnel lens, and that is much lighter and sturdier than a magnifying glass and more useful. Stationery shops tend to sell them, and I say that that's what should be put in front of children, at least to the age of about, say, 16. And I think the effect of computers, even worse than the effect of television, and that's saying something, on children, is a disaster. And so I admire books like Four Arguments for the Abolition of Television by Teddy Goldsmith's American friend Jerry Mander. But, of course, that book won't get publicised. See if you can find my piece on stuff.co.nz, where I sketch the case that the mixed economy that New Zealand developed, gathering momentum from, I don't know where you would start counting, I'm not primarily concerned about that, but through to the mid-60s, it was the nearest thing to a meritocracy that has existed, so far as I know. And the result was that people like me, with no wealthy parents, as long as we kept on passing the exams at a high enough grade and could work in the wool stores, or my favourite job, rubbish collector in Wellington, best job I ever had in many ways. We did have to earn our way through university normally. No one complained about that. And you could keep on getting more educated if you passed the exams. The education system wasn't a dumping ground for unemployed youth, which has now been turned into, let alone for criminal foreigners, which is going on to a distressing extent. So I was privileged to be, when I did my MSc at Vic, it was a university that was visible from around the world, and my master's thesis supervisor, had done his doctorate at Berkeley under a prof who'd since won the Nobel Prize on the basis of his work, among others. And so I got into Berkeley readily, and in those days was able to be a teaching assistant and became a temporary junior lecturer. But yes, that was a golden era when people were promoted in the education system very largely on proven performance. That's long gone now, I'm afraid.
Yeah, quite a change. And what was your first year at Berkeley?
I got there in the fall of 64. I arrived at the International House Fine Hostel. That part was good and straightforward, but around me there suddenly burst so-called free speech.
The free speech movement, yes.
In the fall of 64, Joan Baez would come tooling up the Coast Highway in her E-Type Jaguar and would sing for free, which was pretty unusual, and I had the pleasure of seeing her fairly close up in a fairly small audience, and things erupted around us in this novel and interesting way, which was largely confusing, but there was a lot going on of a kind which seemed at the time to be promising, originating partly in the civil rights movement of the US South, but with novel methods of demonstrating and by and large, non-violent action, and it looked as though it was loosening things up in a healthy way. But if people will study one of its main writers, Hunter S. Thompson, towards the end of Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, Hunter S. did say, I'm speaking just from memory now, we thought we were riding a wave in those days, but now it's cast us up on the beach, and we're left cast. That's what Hunter S. Thompson, and he was a psychedelics fan in a very big way, and thought in the late 60s on into the early 70s that this really was a great surge of freedom and progress. But that early, he saw that it wasn't. It took me quite a lot longer to see, and I still don't have any dogmatic opinions about many aspects of that. But yes, I was at Berkeley when that thing surged, and I would go over the Bay Bridge to the various ballrooms and the Fillmore, and hear. Actually, I had some very interesting concerts by outfits like Big Brother and the Holding Company, and so I'm not just gossiping. I think listeners should know what is a perspective from which somebody purports to advise the public about dangerous multi-billion dollar rackets. So I'm only too happy to outline where I form my attitudes. But that was during a period away from home for the first time when I thought all of this liberation is really good stuff, and so I could readily rationalize desisting from church participation in which I had been raised. And I didn't return to regular participation until 1993 when the funeral of my stepmother pulled me up short, and I realized the church has only to be the least bad organization in order for it to command your loyalty. That's a slogan that nobody has made any comeback at so far. I offer it to listeners in due humility. So I'm practicing Anglican, which is where I was brought up, and that's the perspective from which I appraise PC, and I therefore, of course, condemn the essentially atheistic aspect of all three ideologies. There's nothing particularly Christian about women's lib, that's for sure, and the new racism has no particularly strong influence from Christianity, though some people like the late Archbishop Paul Reeves have been pretty central operatives in it. And of course, militant homosexualism has no healthy connection with Christianity.
Yes, very good. Take a breather for a minute, Bob.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm talking at the moment with Dr. Robert Mann. I've always thought of Bob as one of this country's elder statesmen of the environmental movement. And, of course, the environmental movement was originally composed of environmentalists. these days it's normally referred to as the green movement, and the term green, the label, the brand, didn't exist until it was invented by Fritjof Capra, the physicist, in the early 80s, and is publicized in his book Green Politics, and it achieved currency in this country in the mid-80s as a result of that. But originally the green movement was purely environmentalist, and as someone who just stood on the sidelines and watched that kind of stuff and admired Bob throughout the 70s and his extremely staunch and uncompromising stands in favour of alternative thinking and alternative options and reframing on issues rather than being restricted and bound by conventional viewpoints, I was very much a fan of Bob in those years, and I think it's great that he's still out there doing his thing.
Well, that's all very kind of you, Dennis, but the last little bit is inaccurate. I'm not out there. Ever since a woman was made the director of Radio New Zealand, the boss, I've been blacklisted by Radio New Zealand almost 100%. That happened all of a sudden, and one of the few exceptions was a rigged up interview that Him Kill set up when she was running the morning session, and that led to a defamation suit against me for a remark which certainly would not have been judged defamatory if it ever went to a trial. But people should be aware that there are lawyers that will just lodge a defamation suit for words which they know perfectly well are not defamatory. That is, they don't unjustly damage someone's reputation without being a fair opinion. And there are very unprincipled lawyers in New South Wales notoriously, but in Auckland bulk as well. And so people like myself have been the victims of this cynical racket where it tends to cost you a bit of money to defend yourself against these things. These writs get lodged. Peter Wills was a much more spectacular one. No, the difference is his suit has been settled, but Ever Ready, a union carbide company, sued TV3 and Greenpeace New Zealand and Peter Wills and Peter Atkinson, individuals, scientists who had been on a very high quality documentary about standard cheap smoke detectors with a small amount of radioactive material in them. And the health department, through its fabulous National Radiation Lab in Christchurch, a chronic embarrassment on most issues, they said fallout was okay in effect. And I'm afraid they have a bad record of failing to regulate radiation sufficiently. But this lawsuit was a complete phony, because what was on the TV couldn't defame anybody. Peter merely showed the concept of radioactivity with a lead tunnel moving and a Geiger counter, and that can't defame anybody, let alone the Union Carbide Company or Ever Ready. And this was a multi-million dollar claim. Several lawyers got trips to London on the Concorde, and it was like a bad nightmare John Cleese spoof, with all these lawyers sending letters between each other and lodging interlocutory matters. And years went by, and it was costing quite a lot of people wrongful money. And in the end, TV3 and Marvin Hendrickson was one of the other defendants. He didn't say anything defamatory either. And they settled, you see. So Peter was left with more than $1 million claim. And he had in the end to claim it back, in effect, by a very clever maneuver. So harassment of scientists who try to inform the public is a very real process by really unethical lawyers who are now to a penny, and that has made it much harder. Whereas early on, the Dow Company complained to Colin Maiden, and in the end he tried to purge me, but it wasn't anything like what has been happening since. Nobody actually sued me for saying anything about France. It all has become a chilling influence on public service science. Furthermore, of course, the sabotage of public service science, that is government department and related agencies, the main research labs, the Forest Research Institute at Whakarewarewa. I have contemporaries that had careers there, and now it's been rebranded Scion and is given over to genetic engineering of a very ill-considered kind, which they're doing field trials on. Similarly, Ruakura, the Ministry of Ag research labs there, which had world standing, largely given over to genetic engineering for foreign clients in some cases. So things have gone really wonky. The DSIR, which tried to hire me more than once, was a really respectable, low-budget, high-quality outfit, continuing the meritocracy. Merv Probine, who was the head of the biophysics lab where I worked one summer, he became the State Services Commissioner. He was from obscurity in Mount Albert, as a matter of fact, but he had earned a doctorate and he was a very good administrator in the DSIR, best boss I ever had. And he became a State Services Commissioner, and you could see him standing up to Mulgoon. Now, that's a New Zealand that I remember fondly. But now there's nothing like it, of course. We've got all these CEOs with ludicrous salaries and bonuses and platinum cards and a strange new level. I call them the black suit gang in the universities. We have whole new dozens and dozens of large salaries being paid to managers for whom there's nothing valid to do. They actually don't have a job. And many of my colleagues, I'm glad I'm out of it. I had to retire a decade earlier than I would have in the course of normal events under medical troubles. And my old colleagues that I keep in touch with and continue to do some work with, they're being hassled by bureaucrats within the university in a most preposterous way, and I don't know how I would cope with it, and I don't really know how they do, but that's a sort of obstruction that's going on. The black suit gang making work for themselves rather than facilitating the actual functions of the institution.
And with me is Dr. Robert Mann. We're talking about the dynamics of free speech and the various residual elements of the patriarchy that are being perpetuated by contemporary institutions to limit and prescribe and close down people's natural right of free speech.
That's the theme by and large, but my context is political correctness, and I want to help people to glimpse this tripartite axis. Women's Lib is the oldest and the dominant member, obviously. The New Racism, the newer, and then the Militant Homosexualism, just the most recent third member. But within that, of course, there's a very widespread assumption, such as you just alluded to, that patriarchy can be done away with and that it is a bad thing. Now, I have disposed of that matter in my article with the excellent Andrew McFarlane on our kuratrading.com. Just search for Mann writings and that will get you there. And we point out this matter has been looked into. The key textbook, the definitive edition, was called Why Men Rule, but it came out in the late 60s. This is by Stephen Goldberg of NYU, a very respected senior sociology prof. He looked into it thoroughly and wrote it up, and it turns out that in every society that's ever been investigated by people that can write an account of it, and in the respectable literature, there's never been anything like a matriarchal society. On the contrary, the Amazons are a myth, for example. And Goldberg's book makes it clear in the most scholarly, fully referenced way, every society has ever been, the visible, formal positions of power in public life are held by men. And they make the announcements, having consulted the citizens, including the women, in whatever method, and there's a key part. But always the men make the announcements and take the rap. Sometimes in war. That's the way it's always been. Patriarchy cannot be done away with, and there's no reason to think that it would be desirable. Now, there is one more modern experiment since Goldberg wrote that book. By the way, at the end of the 60s, he racked up the Guinness Book of Records, the record for the most publishers to reject a book that did finally get published. 69 publishers refused to put out a book where a very respectable New York University prof just tells you what is known about patriarchy. The definitive edition, revised years later, is Why Men Rule. So the matter has been settled if people are interested in the truth. But since Goldberg's writing, of course, there's been an innovation in the black slums of North America and, dare I say, parts of our country. There are households where there is no significant, long-lasting adult male presence. That is to say, this is a solo mother, a female-dominated household, and any men that come into the house will, generally speaking, be transient and have no particular power over the children and not much help in bringing them up. That's not patriarchal, and it's a disgrace, and men should reclaim their proper duties. Go to a Promise Keepers conference. That'll wake you up. I did that. I found it pretty impressive. So we've got this warped role for the sexes, this pretense that women and men should have very similar roles in society, and that is a very grave mistake which is causing the most awful trouble through this affirmative action, promoting a so-called victimized minority to positions that they're unfit to fill. And that's the trouble. It's on this myth that patriarchy can be abolished. And I've had numerous obstructions and insults in the normal promotion of my work, broadly speaking, which can only be interpreted as women just wanting to be insolent to an accomplished senior male expert. And of course, the prototype victim was my late colleague, Associate Professor G.H. Green of the National Women's Hospital. That was a world-famous institution, and he was the practical leader of it during a period of dazzling success. And what happens? Along come a couple of super experts. Tom Pierce's daughter Sandra, who had been married to one Miles Coney, and Fiddler Buncombe, later MP, and had to slip off to Mongolia for a while. But these women have gained enormous political power foretelling what is in fact a very carefully contrived pack of falsehoods about the National Women's Hospital. That is what has happened. And I know many of the people that were involved, and I can assure you that that was a very grave injustice. The Herald once printed a letter from me using the phrase the Cartwright travesty, which I was pleasantly surprised it got printed. So this theory that women should occupy the same roles as men has done enormous damage, and in particular it fails to take account. I do hope people will look up Genesis 3 and read it again. There's always something to be gained. We do know that women and men are not the same, and the differences really are important, and a lot is known about them. By and large, men and the distributions overlap. We have to put in these pedantic codicils, but by and large, men tend to be more interested in logic and justice, and women tend to be more interested in emotional relationships. Now, if we arrange the division of labor between the sexes wisely, then it will make the most of those strengths so that women should bring up children for excellent biological reasons. And we should arrange society so that the women will be able to concentrate on taking care of the children. The men will take care in their different ways, but by and large will be out of the household bringing home the bacon. It's not a fluke that it's always been like that, and the attempts to engineer it so that that division of labor is abolished have been disastrous, and now we have widespread derangement among the younger generation. Poor things with these rows of coloured dots in front of them ever since they can remember. There's a very famous psychology prof at Stanford called Philip Zimbardo, and he put out a paper early in the 80s, I remember, because I was just getting involved with personal computers for the first time, and the first Macintoshes came out, and Zimbardo, who is a very famous psychology prof, reported that he and his graduate students had been able readily to find over 400 adolescents just in the Stanford Palo Alto district who were pathologically lost into that imagined world behind that two-dimensional array of colored pixels. This was a form of psychopathology attested to by a most respected expert, and nobody gave a damn. They kept on putting these bloody things in front of the children. So I feel like Carl Stead, somewhat alienated from my own society. Let me plug there C.K. Stead, one of the great old men of New Zealand letters. He wrote an essay called The New Victorians, which was a pioneering analysis of PC in New Zealand back in the late 80s and was reprinted. It came out in Metro magazine, but it was reprinted in a University of Auckland collection called Answering to the Language. The New Victorians is in there, and he denounced the new racists, especially with justice and proper admonition, but what difference has it made to their careers? I've watched them floating on upwards since. So we should combat the new racism. The history of this country is not one of an unwanted military invasion. It turns out to be one of the least unpleasant in the whole era of European colonialism. The Maoris brought the missionaries here. Next year we celebrate that, and I'll be there. Marsden was brought by Ruatara, who'd been to London, and they came back via Parramatta, and it was the Maori's idea to bring the missionaries, and it was by and large an extremely successful, unprecedentedly gentle interaction of a Stone Age people with the most advanced imperial culture, which was at the time suddenly deeply concerned for the welfare of the natives. The Church Missionary Society and the British government, in no uncertain terms, made it clear that the Maoris were to be properly treated. And by and large, they were. They wanted, for a period of some decades, kept pleading with the British government to incorporate us into the empire, please. We need the rule of British law. And the POMs, of course, after the North American embarrassment, were in no hurry to add a far-flung territory which they weren't at all sure they could garrison. So they wouldn't allow groups of New Zealand chiefs to join the empire. Then the French forced the hand. Very interesting episode, underrated. But Maoris had good reason to think the French meant business. They sent a warship to Akaroa, not just a few dozen settlers. So that was the context. And it was, if people would read the history, the years before Waitangi, that's a marvelous book, and very little to regret. I once said to Michael King, who was on a call-in radio show, I outlined the picture in the Bay of Islands early on, and I said, is that true? Was that such a golden era? When Marsden would announce, I have to go back over to Parramatta for a while, unfortunately he was still a magistrate over there. Very bad arrangement. But great warrior chiefs who killed and eaten many men would openly weep in front of their people because they'd sailed the Tasman and they knew he might not come back for various reasons. And then when he did arrive back, they'd again openly weep in front of their people. It was a golden era of cooperation, and there was no unwanted military invasion, except to the extent that the armed rebellion in the 1860s, especially in the Waikato, did occasion a fairly large army to be sent by the Empire because an armed rebellion was on, and the grandfather of my Kandala school deskmate had been hatcheted and all his family in the northern Waikato. So when you put down an armed rebellion, you confiscate much of the property of the rebels after they've been defeated.
Okay, so the point about the history lesson.
Yes, I think it does matter that the history of our country is being rewritten by hate-mongering racists obviously the Jackson Five, the Harawira gang, and practically speaking, the Attorney General, Mr. Finlayson, who's working very hard to dispose of public property that he has no right to dispose of. It's a really wonky period, and now this declaration, we have always owned the water, excellent email rejoined, I've been happy to pass along. Well, in that case, all the money the tribes have been given on the recommendation of the Waitangi Tribunal will be claimed back by the Crown in a suit against the Maori King for flood damage ever since people settled this country. Will be claiming back for damage for all of what their water has done in floods. Now, that to me is a key contribution. I would have been proud to think that one up. Political humour is the main hope of the way things stand. Yes, Minister is obviously a fine example, and there are a few other examples. David MacPhail and Gadsby used to do good political humour, which I'm reliably informed was very annoying to Mulgoon, and rightly so. And I think we desperately need political humour. Murray Ball put out a superb book of cartoons, The Sisterhood, but he cleared off to South Africa for a few years soon after that. And it was a very good book, but he sure got hassled. And there have been only a few attempts to use humour, which I think we need, because it facilitates the flow of thinking between the left hemisphere and the right hemisphere.
Yeah, yeah, it induces cognitive dissonance, which is always helpful to reframing.
Yes, yeah, in itself you're quite right. Cognitive dissonance is not in itself an evil phenomenon, but one must have means to dispose of it, to resolve it validly within a short time. And, of course, as I say, a proper understanding of why we're here, who put us here, and what we're supposed to do according to the indications we have from our Creator. I say that's by far the best way to deal with the jolts that come along when you realize the pattern of thought you'd been used to is not valid. It's not working in one sense or another. And unfortunately, these days, alternative ideologies abound. And on my kuratrading.com, the 1989 essay there sketches them. And not a lot has changed. And there are a lot of very dubious philosophies being pushed now by Richard Dawkins, most obnoxiously, making out that science somehow refutes religion. Terrible rubbish. Trying to do philosophy in which he's very poor. And meanwhile, the really good philosophers and the good scientists, especially John Morton, who was a hero and mentor of mine, they're not honoured, they're hardly remembered, and yet what they wrote about philosophy is far more reasonable than this crude atheism which sells millions of books. So as a Christian, of course, I'm rather annoyed by low-grade philosophers like Dawkins. There are much better.
Yes, I share your dislike for such simple-mindedness, of course. Now, look, we've only got a couple of minutes. We need to look at winding up. I'll make a comment on the social movements that you've been criticising. I just want to make the general comment that I tend to see that stuff as an example of Hegel's dialectic, whereby you have a thesis set up and antithesis forms as a natural reaction in discourse, and social movements are generated and polarised accordingly, but you transcend that polarity by the third means of the third alternative, which is synthesis.
Yes, yes. As a model, that was carried along by the overly modest, the last really impressive Archbishop of Canterbury, professional head of my church, William Temple, and his book, Nature, Man and God, sets it forth as nobody else has done, and people should turn, that's a 1934 you can pick them up, nice hardback, Macmillan, and all of the stuff has been analysed there, and he suggested with undue modesty what he calls dialectical realism. By all means, let those who have faith and who believe in the spirit world, let them discuss decently with the people who disagree with that, and let's see what progress we can make. And I think that's exactly correct, and I'm only too happy to discuss with people. I've tried for years to get a certain militant materialist philosopher to a public debate, but he wouldn't agree to any ordinary terms, and I don't do much arguing anymore. I'm very good at it, but I'd much rather discuss, and you can't get discussion from the feminazis or from the new racists. Not a show. As soon as you show any inclination to discuss their ideological bases, they'll accuse you of misogyny, of course. You criticize women's lib, you must be against all women. That line of desperate illogic is quite common.
And very simple-minded.
Yeah.
Look, Bob, all I would suggest is that whereas we naturally, as human beings, tend to focus on the differences between us, we only move ahead collectively in a healthy and natural manner when we focus on the common ground. So I think in debate, I think we can resolve or transcend to some degree at any one point in time, reframe by focusing on the common ground, acknowledging the common ground, yet not denying the individual differences between us.
No doubt about it. Yes, you sound very much like the excellent Timothy Lynch.
Very good. All right, thanks for being with me today, Bob. This is Dennis Frank signing off for Green Planet FM.
The editing process always shortens an interview, so I've now got time for a final comment. The political left and political right pretend to oppose each other, but they've always agreed that it's okay to destroy nature in order to obtain wealth. That's not the only area of traditional collusion between the left and the right. They also both agree that it's okay to use state power to impose conformity of belief and behaviour upon the populace and eliminate dissent. They appoint people who think like them to positions of authority, so we get political correctness driving the governance of social institutions and polluting everyone's minds with unhealthy ideas and doing their best to ensure that alternative views and opinions are suppressed. So wherever you find censorship, you know it emanates from the traditional collusion between the left and the right, preserved by whichever morons in the population still vote left or right. Dr. Mann's voice in our national media has been suppressed by feminazis and the state broadcaster. How can we be informed on environmental issues if the voices of experts are silenced by these closet Stalinists? Everyone knows that democracies only work if the citizenry is informed. We have a collective right to freedom of information, and it's vital that we do not allow public service media to be controlled by people acting against the public interest. The Green movement is neither left nor right, but in front. The natural function of the avant-garde is to show everyone else the best way forward, so green media ought to feature alternative views and opinions most likely to advance the green cause, particularly those ignored by mainstream media. I therefore appreciate having had the opportunity to present Dr. Mann's priority concerns. Boys are taught to be heroes via fairy tales, myths, legends and history from an early age. For us teenagers of the 60s, the warrior archetype was wrong. So we tried to be peaceful warriors and set out to save the world from war makers, polluters, exploiters, and other evildoers as heroes are meant to do. If someone spends their life campaigning for these good green causes, we should reward them for such public service as elders who can pass on their wisdom to the young. Excluding them from public debate is not only morally wrong, it deprives future generations of role models essential to their survival. Political correctness is a cultural mindset that emanates from the left, and it is poisoning our society and compromising our future. This program has thousands of listeners, and no doubt most belong to or support the Green Party. I encourage all of you to cease and desist from the robotic march to the left that you've been performing for so long and get back on the straight and narrow. I'm Dennis Frank for Green Planet FM, saying goodbye for now.
Thank you for tuning into this Green Planet radio show. I trust you have derived both enjoyment and insight as we empower ourselves with a greater understanding of the magnificent, multifaceted world that we inhabit. In these coming times of rapid change, it's going to take raw courage and inner resolve. And so I thank you as we all remain both focused yet relaxed as we challenge the status quo and let go of the old as we energetically co-create the new paradigm. Because I can assure you, every one of you are important now. When you go to bed tonight, ready for well-earned rest and sleep, Realize that what you think, feel, and do is part of your unfolding destiny. And when we commit to a higher act of goodwill and or community service, Providence also lines up. So that every conversation we have, every email we send, every phone call we make, and every meeting we attend, that we stand in our power and communicate intelligently, warmly, with integrity, knowing that we are actively shaping a collective future that will benefit all our children and grandchildren, as well as that of a larger